So take us to the next amendment.
Okay. Page 3, line 36, it has been suggested that that information, that all this weapons-specific information be deleted. I don't recall where that came, where that recommendation came from.
Who wants to delete?
Renfro.
Renfro. Excuse me, did you say all of the information would be...
That's what I have, that's what my notes reflect. And I don't remember where that came from. No?
I think it would be important that that information be retained for the following reasons. One, it would give the local agency an opportunity to check on the weapon itself, and also to determine if it might be associated, and I think this is in the bill, associated with any particular crimes at the time, or if it's stolen.
I don't know where it got on the list.
Representative Minnis.
One other issue that I like to bring up on when we're talking about serial numbers and makes and models, sometimes gun owners have inscribed their driver's license number or some other number on the weapon. I don't know, maybe you can answer the question. Should we take down that kind of information too if it's present on the weapon, if they inscribe their driver's license number?
Ms. Nichols.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, John Nichols. One of the problems you run into there is that some companies, Smith & Wesson comes to mind, put part assembly numbers on various parts, and so you could wind up with a lot of numbers. Unless law enforcement has an objection, I don't think it's a big issue on that type of thing. I would defer to them, however.
Of course, in most cases, you're not going to have that kind of a number present at the time of sale, unless it's a second purchase or something. So forget that. I think there may be another section of the bill that's more appropriate to talk about it.
Leave line 36, then.
Anybody that can give us any merit to this section, to this proposed amendment? Anybody that would make even the boldest argument in favor?
Mr. Chairman, that might apply very well to the purchase or trade for the used weapon portion of the bill, and that very well might fit that, rather than the new weapons.
You're right.
I don't get any sense from the committee that this is a deal with. So we'll see if somebody wants to lobby us and tell us why that's important.
The first one you can ignore. The second two that are noted, page 6, line 12, and page 6, line 13, were two suggestions. One's the first class mail issue. The other one is just cleaning up the form. Even though the forms are coming out, I believe that these amendments are necessary when we then follow through with Representative Mannix's other amendments. So in order to be consistent, I think that the changes on lines 2 and lines 3 and 4 are necessary.
I'll move the page 6, line 12 amendments for first class after mailed. Any objection?
I have another proposal on this.
Adopted, Representative Mannix.
In addition to that, I'd like to add an amendment wherever we require that things be sent by first class mail to also specify or they can be hand delivered to the appropriate recipient. There are places where, you know, on the way home you could stop by the sheriff's office or the police department or wherever and hand deliver the document. Here in Salem you could drop by state police headquarters, but technically they'd be violating the law and they'd have to go next door and drop it in the mailbox because the law says first class mail.
I think that's a good suggestion, Mr. Sheriff. Portland Police Bureau, the sheriff's department, and the DA's office.
Any objection to that proposal?
To follow any first-class mail postage. Okay, got it.
Adopted. Okay, then we got the next one I'll move will be the change
and it's just a form.
On the form.
Update the form.
So update the form on line, page 6, line 13. Change misdemeanor to Class C felony. Any objection?
Now, going back to Section 1, one of the issues that has been raised, and there is some proposed language on page 3 of the working document, references the issue that the chair raised earlier and has been discussed at some length in the committee, which is creating penalties if the state police does compile or maintain a registry or releases information in violation of the statute. There is some language on lines 18 to 25 of your working document, but that issue is in front of the committee, and we'll have to go into what is currently Section 1. Well, currently Section 1, page 2, line, starting on lines 21, says it is unlawful for the department to compile or maintain a central registry, but it is silent really on the issue of what happens if you do. And
Council,
so
give us the page and line sites again, please, that you're working from.
Page 2, line 21 of the printed bill, which is where it begins to talk about it being unlawful for the state police to compile or maintain the information. Language that has been suggested is on page 3, line 18 of the working document.
Okay. I have a motion on this.
Yeah, I've got a motion as well.
First, I move that. I'm sorry. May I?
I wonder if we should if we move all the figure out if it's plurality or majority, then we'll move from there.
Well, my motion would be first to add where it says it is unlawful for the Department of State Police or any public body. And that may be too broad. You may want to tell me we should say or any state agency, because we actually are requiring the sheriffs to have some registries. Perhaps I'm thinking out loud here. I could see at least saying it is unlawful for the Department of State Police or any state agency. Because they just send it up next door to the Department of Fish and Wildlife or something.
I think
the registry.
Isn't that in the working? Isn't that something like that?
I'm not sure where this language came
shall
from.
Shall be unlawful for any division of state or local government? That's what's in the working document.
That's what, yeah.
All right. I would go for that. That would be my proposal then. That's the first one.
Representative Clark, you have
a my motion. My motion has nothing to do with that and is not contradictory to that.
Well, that would be a follow-up as to how we enforce it. I'll present that, too. I had some language that I had read in another draft of the bill, but I think the penalty is too high. I would propose that we would say that violation of this section is a Class C misdemeanor. Any officer or employee of the state who violates the provisions of this section shall be subject to disciplinary action as well as criminal prosecution.
Can you fit that into what's in the working document somehow?
Let me switch back. What page of the working
page
document?
Page 3. 17 through 24.
I had a question about how how or if this is going to affect our study.
Doesn't.
Are we sure it's not going to affect our study?
We're supposed to take the basic information and send back the fingerprint anyway.
This is just information. This is just the names of purchaser and the fingerprint identification, which cannot be kept. And the fingerprints are supposed to go back anyway. Well, we were talking about, actually, the committee raised that issue yesterday.
It doesn't say right now.
No.
I would want it to, I'll work from the working document here and say that other than for purposes of the study prescribed by this 1989 Act, it shall be unlawful for any division of state or local government to compile or maintain any information on lawful purchases of weapons. Neither shall they distribute any such information to any other private or governmental entity. Then we have that other sentence, the respective chiefs of police, county sheriffs, and head of the state police shall be, well, I would then say any state official. Violation, I wouldn't even say who's responsible at that point. It's just a violation of this section is a Class C misdemeanor and may subject any government official to disciplinary action in addition to criminal prosecution.
My only question would be the violation standard.
Keeping a record.
I would tend to look at, what we're saying, I think we're trying to strongly say that these records are not to be kept or compiled and would consider that a real serious breach of the intent of this bill if they were, and should be a Class C felony, just like any other fraudulent behavior in this bill is.
Okay, you want to be a tough guy. It's all right with me.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Sheriff Burks is my name. The concern I have here is that currently you have a standard which is under the public records law in which the duplicate copies of the records sales are kept in every agency pursuant to the public records law. So So bear that in mind. If you change it, you're going to have to somehow also affect the public records law. Also, because this is things that we're doing now, I'd be very concerned about making this a felony and holding some clerk who didn't get the word accountable as a felon. At least you ought to insert the same privilege of knowingly.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'd accept Representative Bryan's friendly amendment to make it a Class C felony, but also the sheriff's friendly suggestion, and I would amend my proposal to make it a knowing violation. You're going to have to play the tape back to keep up with this, counsel.
I think the way this is
videotaped. There's no way I can do it. Let's backtrack.
I think the way this is written, it would actually be the sheriff or chief of police that would be held liable for the acts of their employees.
And I had proposed that we change that to any state official. So that someone who's starting to keep their own little file drawer in the back office where they kind of slip these things in there instead of shredding them or disposing of them, that they too would be any state employee is even better.
Representative Mannix, would you like to give us...
All right. My conceptual suggestion is first that from the working document, we say, other than as specified in regard to the study to be conducted pursuant to this 1989 Act.
Notwithstanding the study.
Notwithstanding the study.
Or should we have the study say notwithstanding this Act, the study would be... which?
That's
either way, conceptually I want to say notwithstanding the study that needs to be conducted, separate from that, other than the study, which is a two-year study.
Okay.
It shall be unlawful, and then we use this language, for any division of state and local governments, as on lines 18 through 24 with the following modifications, so council can look at this. Instead of saying the respective chiefs of police, county sheriffs, and head of state police shall be criminal liable for such a violation, I'd want to put in any public employee who knowingly, is that the standard we had used before?
Intentionally.
We've been using intentionally with Class C felonies.
Who intentionally violates this prohibition shall be liable, is guilty of a Class C misdemeanor. Excuse me, Class C felony.
I think we're going to have to work on the conceptual amendment. We're trying to move quickly today.
Sub C, line 21 through 25 on page 2, started off talking about the triplicate sheet, which is unique in that it contains the thumbprint. And that part, we were trying to make sure a central registry was not created by the state police, who was the only party having that. And we're broadening it to these other agencies who don't even receive the triplicate. I'm wondering if we are getting more broadly focused than what we were talking about originally. What we're trying to do is make sure that the Department of State Police do not use this thumbprint and applicant identification to start a central registry. That was a real hot button that I heard during the testimony, was this concept of being a big file drawer somewhere.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bryan, if I could respectfully disagree, actually what this all deals with primarily is the duplicate, is the second sheet, because the triplicate's got to go back.
Well, I'm referring to page lines 21 through 25.
Correct.
And the triplicate sheet in sub B goes back to the local jurisdiction.
Correct.
We talked about having triplicate go back to the gun dealer. Right,
and the
agency who got the duplicate would get a notice, because I think Sheriff Burks mentioned that they need to know what the state police found.
Correct.
They need to get a notice that the triplicate goes back to the gun dealer, so the citizen can, when he picks up his gun after 15 days, actually pick up that triplicate. He knows he's got.
Is that a motion?
The applicant.
Did you accept that as an amendment to your conceptual amendment?
No. It's a different place in the statute. No. It's a different part of the statute. It's
I will
a different
state
part of the
my
bill,
intention
so.
Here. My intention is that there be no registry anywhere, whether or not it's a state central registry or the sheriff is even maintaining his own little registry of all the people in his county who have bought handguns. Because 36 county registries can quickly become a state registry, And this is, yes, I'm back to the original concept of not wanting to have government being aware, to be blunt about it, as to who does have firearms out there. That's an issue that we need to be aware of. And the intention that I would have here is that we say, in effect, for 2 years you can accumulate this information, you can conduct this study, okay, for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, that's over. After that, you're not supposed to be maintaining this information anywhere, and it's not just the thumbprint, it's all of this information, except for one thing. When you get these forms, you can quickly trace to see whether or not that was a stolen firearm, or while you have it, you can make note of it in case it's used in the commission of a crime. But that's it. Then the stuff evaporates.
Mr. Chair.
I think that Representative Clark.
Go ahead.
I think that your suggestion and Representative Lyon's suggestion are
similar. They're going to two separate parts of the bill.
Okay, let's. Why don't we, Representative Clark?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think if what you're trying to get at is the statement that was in the original printed bill doesn't mean anything. It says it's unlawful. You know, great, so what? So what we're trying to do is to put in a real hammer so that the heads of agencies say to their employees, if you are ever caught doing this, you need to understand what happens, and they show them the statute that says this is serious stuff. So I think to that extent, Representative Mannix's suggestion that you hook in to an individual employee who intentionally violates this section is probably real good. It's probably a lot of incentive there for someone to comply with the law. My motion is not at all inconsistent with this, and it has to do with what happens if you discover or suspect that in fact there is being a registry being kept. What do you do at that point? How do you, first of all, you can report it to the DA, and DA can go charge some worker with keeping a state registry in violation of this section. But you need to have what I typically call a private right of action. You need to be able to come in and sue the public body in a civil suit for violation of civil rights, because that's what this is. When you're talking about the right to keep and bear arms, it's a constitutional right. And the ACLU or anybody else, if we were dealing with free speech or criminal process protections, would come in and sue you on a violation of civil rights claims, and they would ask for their attorney fees under federal Section 1983. My conceptual motion and amendment would be twofold. One is to give somebody a private right of action to sue the public body that's violating this, at which point you would be able to have discovery and find out exactly what are they keeping. And secondly, to provide for attorney fees in the event that you're successful. I think those two additions to what Representative Mannix is proposing will make this a meaningful section that's not just public agency bashing, but will put it on the same standards as a whole bunch of other statutes out there that tell public bodies you can't go around violating people's civil rights.
Mr. Chairman?
Counsel.
Question to Representative Clark. If in addition to what Representative Mannix said, there was language added that would say something to the effect of nothing in the statute limits your ability to sue under other existing laws, would that accomplish the same thing? Or
I don't think so, because it doesn't give you the private right of action. And there is a huge question in Oregon law. Pretty clear, you don't have a statutory right to attorney fees for a civil rights claim under Oregon constitutional law unless you can satisfy the standard in Darris versus Myers, which is basically impossible to satisfy. Okay. So you got to have a statutory right of attorney fees for a civil rights violation.
I like that idea, and I think it should be specified. It is a private right of action in regard to violation of this section. And I think you can have it parallel with the criminal prosecution, because no one may want to bring the private right of action.
Right.
And I think that turning a corner on this whole documentation issue is we could just say for 2 years you can keep these records. After the study time is over, you must destroy these records. Why don't we be proactive and just specify that they may use these records for purposes of checking the person's background, checking to make sure the firearm that's just been sold is not shown as having been stolen, and otherwise, they must destroy the records, period.
think the ideas that have been bouncing around are pretty good, particularly the private right of action aspect and specifically the destruction of records as a requirement. One of the loopholes I see in this bill, in the language, we're talking about the state police and public entities. However, handgun dealers would have access to these forms, and it could be very easy for copies or records within their premise also. I guess I would like a little bit broader language that would, instead of dealing with state police or any police agency, just say that no person may compile any of the information that's contained on this form and deal with the person aspect so that we're covering firearms dealers or anybody else that might have access to these forms so that they're not piecemealy photocopying them, keeping records, and somehow having access to information.
Other than as required by federal law.
Well, yeah, that's fine. I guess what I'm saying is that we don't want firearms dealers who have access to this to be compiling their own records either, because they could very easily give those same records to a local law enforcement agency who could circumvent them, not getting it from the state police or another public agency.
Mr. Chairman, John Nichols, that was my comment. The federal law states that a dealer must keep records under pain of $10,000 and 10 years in the federal bucket for a period of 20 years, I believe it is. So I would hope that they would exempt that from. I had one other.
May I follow up on that, though? There's 2 points. One is we can easily, I think Representative Minnis has got a good point there. If we would say, other than as required by federal law, nobody should be compiling these records. And the second thought I have is I could see dealers issuing lists of all the purchasers of handguns to people, say, well, you like to sell secondary market stuff, you like to sell ammunition, and, you know, selling them to catalog companies, mailing lists, and I don't think it's appropriate for them to do that. Now, if they want to have customers who sign up for mailing lists, that's one thing, but if they're using their these forms to provide them with information for marketing purposes, I don't agree with that. So let's just say you can't keep this information other than as required by federal or state law.
Mr. Chairman, does federal law require you to keep that information confidential or not?
I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Minnis, I think that's available to police officers. In the course of an investigation of a crime, you can go to the dealer and search through the records and perhaps find some of the information you're after. I'd like to raise one other point which might be interesting. It might come to the attention of the police, for example, as the clerk is checking the sales of handgun records, that, oh, yeah, I remember this guy. He was involved in a domestic dispute last night with his wife or a fight with the police or whatever. And she tells the sergeant or whatever, and he makes a flag in the computer, this guy is perhaps dangerous, and that record of that sale of that gun may need to be kept, or the serial number of that gun in case it's a future crime. Now, you may want to be prohibiting that type of action, but I can tell you that's occurring probably today. And I can also tell you that currently every police agency maintains, according to the public records law, all of those duplicate sales of handgun sheets that come in. So you're going to be making a rather dramatic change, and you are taking away leads that the police, I'm sure, use in solving crimes at this time.
No, you can't.
What is the NRA position on that?
Regarding the, well, the indication is right now that information is not of confidential nature. I need to make a phone call. I'm looking at the time frame. I can find out from the federal authorities in about 2 minutes.
Well, I'm not worried about the confidentiality so much as Sheriff Burke mentioned that right now they keep a list of all the handgun purchasers as those come in. They keep copies at all the sheriff's offices.
And you're required by law to do that.
Required by law to keep those reports on hand, and they keep them, and they're available under the public records law. Do you have a position on whether or not that should be done under this bill?
Well, I don't think that's... Has that come up in discussion before?
We've talked about it. And we agreed to disagree on the subject.
Yeah, because I would not agree with that if we're not bound by the agreements, my coming in late to this situation. I'm not, I believe that information should not be available. And I will, let me point, if I may, to Hawaii as a classic example. You know, we have often said and worried about the misuse of information that is compiled on a compulsory nature with a promise that we'll never use this against you. In 1985, The president of Hawaii, for instance, has registration, compulsory registration of rifles, shotguns, and handguns. When that was put on the books, it was mentioned at the time, and there was the promise at the time, of course, understanding that promises sometimes can be broken, that this information will never lead to confiscation. But in 1985, a bill was introduced by the president of the Senate calling for the total confiscation of all handguns using the registration lists that were compiled under law in Hawaii. Now, that bill died. We are vehemently opposed to it. But the reason it died is you cannot confiscate without due compensation. And the price tag of just confiscating handguns in Hawaii was estimated at $31 million, about 31 times their budget surplus. The reason I believe it died was economic rather than political wherewithal, a commitment to do that. So we have a real concern about the compilation, the retention of records. That's why when it comes to stolen firearms, it's easier for the citizen to report to NCIC the serial number of his arms. Therefore, they're entered in the computer, and the registration is completed on the part of the citizen after the fact, albeit, but nonetheless, it serves the purpose.
Okay, I'll tell you what, we got a lot of stuff to move through. What I'm going to do is move a conceptual amendment, and then if we don't get everything accomplished off of our next working document, we'll be able to potentially work this area. We're going to leave the suggestion out because apparently that might conflict with federal. Yeah. Not that we can revisit this later on, but just to make it possible, we'll move Representative Mannix's original conceptual amendment. Appropriate to put the notwithstanding language into the study as opposed to here.
Right. I agree with that.
And also move Representative Clark's session. Either of Representative Clark, Minnis, or Mannix would like to have some input on if we don't get it quite right, we'll work it some more next time.
Is that going to include the requirement of destruction of records?
Yes, so I'll make that part of the motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, it would be my recommendation that you put in at the end of the study, that all records compiled for the purposes of the study shall be destroyed upon its completion, as opposed to putting it in the it is unlawful section.
All right.
And we can move that, and I can take care of it. But I think that if you want them destroyed, I would put it at the tail end.
I agree with that.
How about if we include a section in the it is unlawful section stating that if there are any compilations found, they shall be destroyed, and that the violation of that shall also be
because I complain long
and
loud about
it. Goes without saying, because it would be a felony, and you'd be able to seize and destroy it under criminal law.
Mr. Chairman, may I state this? My understanding of the conceptual amendment will be we're going to have a two-year study. These forms must be transmitted as provided already. For purposes of that study, it's okay to keep this information, either a state registry, even a local registry type, for purposes of the study. At the completion of the study, all records must be destroyed. In addition, it's unlawful to maintain these kinds of records other than for purposes of that study. And these records, when they're submitted, can be reviewed, but then must be destroyed. And I'd say promptly destroyed to some sort of timeline. And yes, it's my specific intention with this to require that no one be keeping locally or at statewide records as to who purchased firearms.
Representative Council, is that
correct? Yeah.
Representative.
It might not look exactly like that, but we'll get it.
I guess I want to ask a question of staff, too, in terms of the kind of study that they're looking at. I guess I would advocate that they're required to destroy the information within 10 days after receipt. And the reason that I say that is because for the purpose of the study, we don't need people's names, addresses. They can take the statistical information in terms of demographics, age, race, whatever income levels, whatever it is that they're trying to ascertain. And they don't need the names, addresses, and so on and so forth, and if they're going to break it down by region of the state or locale or so on and so forth, once they've taken that information, statistical data off of the report, there's no reason for them to keep the form.
I agree with that friendly amendment.
I'll step in as a friendly amendment.
Sure.
Let's try, and if it doesn't work, we'll come back and try it again.
Okay.
Mr. Nichols had his finger up there.
Mr. Nichols, do you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I presume this will still allow the police to keep records that are necessary for criminal prosecutions.
Yes.
They would not be...
That goes without saying.
I think we should specify... May I, Mr. Chairman? We should specify as an exception, if the police note upon receipt of the document that there's a need for that document for purposes of criminal prosecution, that they just advise whoever transmitted the document to them that they are not destroying that document.
Well, yeah, but we can...
I want some procedure where they can't just say, well, we're keeping all of this for possible criminal prosecution. They should identify a particular document that they've set aside for purposes of potential prosecution.
That intent should also be noted in the conceptual amendment.
Major Renfro had his hand up.
Yes. Major Renfro, have a comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, it would be particularly important that copy with the fingerprint that positively identifies the individual be retained.
Evidence at that point.
Well, but I want it to be designated as such to be some record that this is why this wasn't destroyed. You know, this is evidence of someone who's trying to fraudulently purchase a weapon.
Forms may be retained.
Sir, Representative Mannix, I thought you wanted to shorten the ORS. It's not like...
Mr. Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mannix, in pursuing that, it's been brought to my attention that we're providing for the destruction of those records, but there's not a confidentiality attached to those. So, in fact, pending in the interim of the 2 years...
to forge or to falsify. So my view, if you had one of those other items, such as a birth certificate or naturalization card or one of those items with a driver's license, would probably be sufficient. I don't like the driver's license, but I think that's going to be improved.
Well, some of us have noted, for instance, Mr. Chairman, on documentation of origin, I guess... It's not too hard to get a birth certificate. Naturalization, similarly. But you get into alien registration card, I guess some aliens are supposed to carry those, so they should have that pretty handy. Many of us have passports, but a lot of us don't. Military ID card, if you've been in the service. Aren't there some other kinds of cards that would help document origin that show someone's been somehow checked out? Or, as an alternative, how about something that... documents that you've been in that community for, say, 6 months, even though it's not as fancy a document.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, there are local documents, government documents, that I personally would not object to.
Can you give us the list?
Well, not immediately, but there may be some local county or municipal documents of some type that may be verified.
If I can, counsel's ready to move us into the next amendment. We'll leave this thing alone until the next time. I have a whole different set of feelings on this, and I might get a chance to just talk to some members of the committee. let's move on, just because this seems like one that'll take... We spent a lot of time on this last time, and...
I agree, Mr. Chairman. Can I raise a quick, separate issue in terms of paperwork?
Please, Representative Mannix.
I'm concerned about the amount of paperwork we're creating here, or that already exists here, and I'm wondering what anyone's reaction is to the idea of saying, look, you've gone to the dealer, you filled out this form, and you're cleared, and you purchased your handgun. How would you feel about saying that that dealer, with your permission, could keep on hand that triplicate for the next, say, 3 months, and should you decide to purchase another handgun or long gun during those 3 months, that he could still rely on that original application. It's for that dealer on hand, but you'd have to leave it with him, and you'd have to voluntarily agree to leave it with him, just so that if someone wanted to buy two guns in 3 months, they didn't end up having to send through two sets of forms. Or maybe 6 months. I mean, some limited time frame, knowing that people can go out and commit mayhem within the next 3 months.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I'd have any problem, Representative Mannix, I'd have any problems with that, except under the federal law, I think you're probably going to be required to fill out.
Okay, you've got to fill out the federal form, but let's cut out all the state processing, save you some money, too.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, if you choose, for example, not to... require the fingerprints for the long barrel weapons. then there would not be a need for the triplicate to be forwarded to the state police, because on a local level, they could run a check on a name and date of birth. And so, therefore, there would, you would save quite a bit of paperwork.
First of all, then, when we do the long gun study, if we decide against fingerprints for long gun, forget page 3 of the triplicate, throw it out. Same form, but throw it out. Second of all, I go in to Tandy Sporting Goods and I want to buy a handgun. I fill out these forms. Then I decide 2 months from now, or I think I might want to get another one in a couple of months. The option I was looking for was let me leave when I get my thumbprint approved thing back, saying to Tandy, Steve Tandy, hey, look, I'd like to leave this with you for the next 3 months. I may want to come back and buy another handgun.
Yes. For the purpose of the study, don't they need to know the number of weapons, caliber, types, those kind of things?
That's right. Thank you. Never mind.
Let's move on from this point. The council will take us into the next. We've got a lot of little technical amendments we can get through because we want a good, clean copy of the bill next week.
Okay, Section 2. The first amendment that was suggested was raised yesterday by Mr. Marshall. Page 7, line 32 of the bill, insert the word reasonable before clause, which I think everyone sort of agreed with, but needs to be moved.
Okay.
So the person has reasonable cause to believe.
I was wondering whether we should use reasonable cause or if we should get this to a knowingly standard.
That's probably most appropriate, actually.
Any comments from the committee? Representative Clark, what do you think?
I think that's reasonable cause is some sort of an objective standard that a third person can pass judgment on. Knowing is difficult to prove.
Do we have, I just know from... kind of a standard definition for reasonable cause. We have no
reasonable person standard.
You know, the other way you could go about it, I suppose, would be to say knows or reasonably should know. That's the same standard.
It's the same standard.
It's just semantics.
What a reasonable person under those circumstances.
Exactly.
Knows or should know.
But at that point, you get right back to a reasonable standard.
But it's still the reasonable person standard.
I kind of prefer the knows or should know language. Does anybody have any preference on that?
Knows or should knows as opposed to has reasonable cause?
I don't think it makes any difference.
Okay.
It's fewer words this way.
I'm going to...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
Reasonable cause, there's a lot of different civil cases where reasonable cause is discussed in terms of civil sanctions and the like, and I'm comfortable with saying has reasonable cause to believe because we get into the reasonable man standard. We use the reasonable person standard in negligence cases and so on and so forth. And it's something that would give us, I'd be satisfied that that's pretty good guidance. We get back to the reasonable person standard. So I'm comfortable with saying has reasonable cause to believe.
That's not, I don't think, it's much of a used criminal law standard in Oregon, but it's interesting that it's a civil law standard. So I wonder.
Well, this is a civil relief section, actually. So, I mean, it's a violation of the section is a Class C felony, but when you also get into it, into interpreting the list,
the standard of action is what we would expect a civilian to follow. And we, on the tort side and the negligence side, we expect civilians to act like the reasonable person. And here, if we said reasonable cause, at least I'd be stating for the record right now, that would be my intention, was that a reasonable person standard would apply.
My little problem here, if I can be clear on it, is that this is a criminal statute.
He's right.
And it could say knowingly or recklessly does this, and that would make sense because then it's defined in... your uniform jury instructions and so on and so forth, and we know what we're going to tell the jury. But I
recklessly disregard knows or what? Well, let's
knows or has reasonable.
We could go as low as wreck.
Mr. Nichols is sitting here shaking his head, realizing that this is what happens when you let a bunch of lawyers get hold of a simple idea.
We're having an aside here that wasn't even concerned with this portion of the bill.
Recklessly.
Well, I think knows or has reason to know. And knows or has reason to believe, I think, is probably how you want it to read then.
Yeah, if we get even to the reason to believe, I don't know if that's defined in the Typically, in Oregon statutes, you use the
knowingly is the lowest.
The lowest is criminal negligence.
Oh, you're right.
And then recklessly is next, and then knowingly, and then intentionally. So I think we, I don't know, maybe we can explore that.
All right, so you want the lowest criminal...
Well, the lowest would be criminal negligence, and I don't think we want to do that.
Well, it's a class of felony, so...
Let's plan on, if we can, let's plan on stuffing knowingly in there, and then we'll have counsel... ...accepted in the criminal law.
Well, you are dealing with a class C felony, and we have made seller... I mean, most other seller violations have all been raised to intentionally.
Intentionally.
So, I think that...
May I suggest something?
Somehow you have to make those that's consistent.
Representative Mannix.
I suggest we look for guidance to the OLCC statutes regarding serving liquor to minors, because they've had to deal with the question as to whether or not someone looks so young that they ought to ask for their ID. And we're dealing with a lot of things in terms of appearances here, and perhaps counsel could look for some guidance there.
All right.
Why don't...
I haven't been carded in a long time. I'm so disappointed.
Want to move something for now, then we'll get that in there. We'll have counsel back to us.
Yeah.
Let's sense it's consistent with the rest of it. I'm going to move intentionally, just to put it in here to get that.
Okay.
That's my intent on the intentionally motion. At least temporarily adopted.
All right. Now, Section 2, we've got two technical amendments. The first one is on page 7, line 32. If you read it, it reads, or otherwise transfer any firearm to any person whom the, and someone has suggested inserting other person.
How about transfer or has cause to believe? Or whatever.
Transferor as opposed to just other person?
You're saying to any person, then we want to know whom the person has caused. Do you want to be clear about who we're referring to? Is that the point?
Yes, that's the problem.
Well, yeah, then we could say whom the transferor has caused to believe, and then we're making it clear that it's the acting party.
Okay. Is that all right? That was your, it was your other. That you were the one that raised the issue.
I did.
It's a good point for clarity.
It is, because it's real unclear. Okay.
Okay, any comments from the panel on that? Okay, let's... Mannix's motion, objection? Adopted.
Okay, the next one, line 21, this is consistent with what we did before, which is to just rewrite line 41 so it would read, has been convicted of a felony or found guilty except for insanity of a felony pursuant to, and we'll make, we're going to start putting that all that other language in. Just so that reads clearly.
Have a motion on that? I'm kind of scribbling this other little note here, so. Adopted.
Now the next question is, we have already defined misdemeanors of violence. I think it was suggested as defined in this act, but I think since there's a definition section in this bill, I don't think we need to do that. Anybody got any thoughts on that? I mean, it says misdemeanor including involving violence is defined by this act, or is the fact that it's going to be in the definition section going to be adequate to cover that?
Being in the definition section is adequate, in my opinion.
Now, all right, time to switch gears and start looking at the list, because there have been a lot of issues raised with the list.
Talking about lines 38 through 44 and 7. One through.
Well, actually, the problems have been raised in F, G, H, I, and J. So let us deal with G and H first. I don't know why I'm.
Can I back us up for a moment?
Sure.
This age factor. Can I hear from law enforcement as to why we're making it? I can understand somewhat why we're making a distinction between 18 and 21 regarding handgun, well, long gun, handgun. Is this a compromise that's real important to the fabric of this bill, Or could some of us who like simplicity, who would like to say one age fits all, is that going to ruin this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, the reason the two different ages were put in was to conform with federal law, which prescribes 18 for a rifle or shotgun and 21 for a handgun. Other than that, there wasn't any reason for it.
All right, then we'll just stick with it for conformity. Thank you.
Makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Conform with federal law to make have the age distinction?
Have the age distinctions.
Okay. Let me just try to review for the committee what the problems have been raised with G and H. Some proposed suggestions about how to fix it, if possible, and then the committee can take over. There was an intent on behalf of the working group to prohibit those people that were unlawful users of or addicted to controlled substances or chronic abusers of alcohol to be on the list of persons who would be prohibited from owning firearms. And this same list is ultimately repeated in the concealed weapons section, so also from having concealed weapons. The issue was raised that these are probably unconstitutionally vague. Certainly there's a problem of proof. One of the suggestions that was raised, and you'll see some language on page 5 of the working document, talked about objective criteria and to somehow tie it to convictions. And if you look at pages 18 to 22 of page 5 of the working document, some language that has been played with would read something like, has been convicted of a crime, an element of which is the use of alcohol or controlled substances, has been convicted of an offense contained in the Uniform Controlled Substances Act, or as a condition of a sentence in order to participate in a substance abuse counseling or treatment program. The advantage of this kind of using this kind of language is that this is at least the convictions would be part of your criminal record. It would give you something it would give you something objective to say that the person obviously had some involvement with drugs and alcohol, assuming you're going to make a connection between drugs and alcohol and use of firearms. In terms of the condition of the sentences, I think that would be harder information to get, but it is obtainable. I'm not sure if there's on the federal list if they address this issue. Not specifically. I mean, unless the crimes of violence, unless your felony offense or your crimes of violence involve these, in which case it would not be an issue. Actually, we've gotten some number of phone calls on this because obviously if you're convicted of driving under the influence, you would be, at least in this situation, prohibited initially from owning a gun, and you'd have to go and make a case that your driving under the influence conviction did not make you an inappropriate person to be able to buy a rifle. Sure. It's certainly an issue that is probably complex at best.
Representative Mannix.
I think that a friend from the NRA has some information. Have you gotten some verification from Washington about some language in regard to this, or were you looking for some language on another element of the problem?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, the information that I was referring to is the Section 4, I believe, the mental capacitated.
All right.
We hadn't got into this. I've got the federal law, but it's out in the car, and I have sufficient copies for the committee if they care for me to get them.
Actually, I'm pretty much satisfied with the language that counsel suggested, and I'm willing to move that as an amendment. In fact, I do so. And my only comment is in regard to driving under the influence, life is hard. Go see the judge.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I just thought that through a few minutes ago, and that's an absolutely appropriate consequence of a DUI conviction in my mind.
It certainly, if you consider the fact that felonies will exclude you, if you consider the fact that misdemeanors involving violence will exclude you, there are going to be the list of crimes that would fit this definition is not going to be terribly broad, I don't think. But on the other hand, I think that the current language is probably unworkable. The language in the bill is I think, unworkable.
So the language counsel suggests is at least is an improvement.
Drugs and alcohol.
I'm not sure on the I'm not sure about alcohol. I'd have to review it again. It's been a while.
I've not yet been impressed that the feds know that much more than we do about writing legislation anyway. We seem to do a very nice job here.
I just don't know if some of this was on their list. I know that a lot of the mental health stuff has been addressed, and I just don't know if they...
I can't remember.
Anyway, Mr. Chairman, I'm willing to move that language as a substitute.
Take that motion. Is there any objection to that motion? So moved and amended. Council, what's our next section we want to address in here?
F, I, and J. There has been significant discussion about how to deal with persons who have been adjudicated mentally ill or are on other, to be found to be diagnosed to be dangerous to self or others, or under the supervision of the PSRB, which actually, if you were found guilty but for insanity, you would be under the PSRB. It has been suggested...
Who else is under the PSRB?
Only persons that have been found...
Don't need... So that's redundant.
Correct. Let me just finish here.
Okay.
It has been suggested that F, I, and J come out, and that the following language be used instead. And I'm working from the working document. The person was committed to the mental health division after a judicial finding, either pursuant to the commitment statutes or a finding of dangerousness to self or others. It's basically the same thing as being adjudicated mentally ill, except for that it just goes a little bit further, and as a result of that adjudication, the person gets committed to the mental health division. What makes this language a little bit trickier is that currently probate judges are not required to make that specific finding. And I don't know how the committee wants to deal with that issue. One can be committed for not being able to care for oneself. Then the question becomes, do you want to prohibit those persons from having guns as well? The committee may choose to answer yes, in which case it's not an issue.
I answer yes.
Let me just finish. You'll also note on line 2, page 6 of the working document, that it says within the previous, and there's a blank. Some proponents would like to see that limited to 2 years. If a person has been found to be mentally ill and committed to the mental health division, the committee has to address the issue of how long after that commitment they should be prohibited from purchasing a firearm. I would note for the committee's information that for so long as generally commitments are good for 180 days, if you remain in a psychiatric hospital, they have to be renewed every 6 months, every 180 days. But once you have been discharged, how long should that discharge follow you, so to speak, so that you remain disqualified?
Chairman,
let me just one other point of information, and then I'll shut up. The part of this bill which the committee has adopted is that misdemeanors of violence are good for 4 years, or not good, serve the purpose of disqualifying you from purchasing a firearm for 4 years.
Concealed weapon permit for 4 years.
And the lists are the same, so whatever the committee decides on this list, unless there are significant policy reasons why they want to do something differently, the way this bill is written, the same list that the committee develops now will probably also be used for the concealed weapons permits part.
Representative Clark, Chair.
I see no reason to treat, lots of thoughts, I'll try and sort them out here. I see no reason to treat people who have been adjudicated mentally ill, whatever that means, differently than people who have been convicted of misdemeanors involving violence. To the extent that we have said that those folks are going to be entitled to own a gun or able to get a gun if they can go convince a judge of that. And it seems to me that that's an appropriate process to be used here as well, that instead of talking about absolute prohibitions, we're talking about excluding these people from automatically qualifying subject to judicial review. I'm going to throw that out as a concept because it seems to me that I mean, I'm somewhat familiar with commitment processes, and I know what it means and what it doesn't mean. It does mean something, it doesn't mean everything, just like a misdemeanor involving violence. It tells you something, but it may not tell you everything. So I want to throw that out as one possibility. I want to throw out a pitch for treating for a similar kind of time period. And I want to ask why in the world the language in the working document brings the mental health division into it.
Because generally, if you are, the findings of the judge is that you are found to be mentally ill and committed to the mental health division. Opponents of that language are here. Maybe they can respond, but they wanted it. Basically, it's persons that are involuntarily committed to state hospitals. Limits it. The impact of this is to limit it to people who are committed to state hospitals, basically. So you go a step further than the commitment. I mean, a step further than a finding of mentally ill and into the, I mean, generally speaking, and I have to confirm this, the judge finds you mentally ill and commits you to the mental health division for placement, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was the language proposed by those persons in the mental health field.
Okay, and I want to talk to my colleagues on the committee here for a minute and say the thrust of the bill and the thrust of 4 days of testimony that we've heard is how do we make sure that guns stay out of the hands of the people that we have concerns about? And if we were going to absolutely say forever none of these people could ever own guns, that's one thing. If we were going to say we're going to make it tougher, then that's something else. And I'm reluctant to narrow the definition in that way, particularly if we have an appeals process, because the I'm going to overly stereotype, but the people who brought this bill to us said we're after two groups of people: people who are mentally unstable and shouldn't own guns, and people who are criminals and shouldn't own guns. That's who we're after, and we're putting the average citizen through a whole bunch to get at these folks, and so I want to make an argument for staying steady-eyed on this provision.
I buy your argument. I'd like to propose this as a scheme. First of all, if you've been under the supervision of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, that's pretty heavy-duty stuff. From my connection with the state hospital, which is in my district, the people who are out there will tell you you're more worried about them than the people who are in the state penitentiary. And I would want to first say that if you've been under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, that there's no time limitation on being barred, but you can, as there's a provision here that says you can apply to a judge to establish that you're okay. If it was so heavy that that's where you were put, and these are people that are usually going to be taken care of by the guilty except for insanity, but not always. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they are all guilty except insanity. Are they all guilty except insanity, Major Renfro?
Larry has that question. Larry?
Chair Representative Mannix, I believe so.
All right, then don't worry about that one. We've taken care of them with the guilty except for insanity on a felony. Your 4 years, I need to know if you mean 4 years. The misdemeanors involving violence are 4 years, but and they can apply to a judge even within the 4 years, but after 4 years, that evaporates. We could say a parallel is if you are placed in the custody of the mental health division, period, within the past 4 years, period. But, of course, if you could still apply to the judge. Otherwise, that evaporates after 4 years. Is that what you're thinking, Representative Clark?
No, I was thinking of the prohibition.
Starting at what point? The point of commitment, the point of discharge?
4 years from the point of commitment to the custody of the mental health division. I would agree with that, but not require that it be a dangerousness commitment. I saw him nod as he left, even though he was out of the TV.
Back in a few minutes.
Does that sound? That would be my proposal, Mr. Chairman. 4 years from the date of commitment, which is to me the same almost as a conviction, to the mental health division.
Private mental hospitals.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you can actually be committed to a... You can be placed in a psychiatric facility, but I don't think you can be committed to...
The five-day police
hold. That's a different issue. We didn't get there yet.
We may have some information out here, Mr. Chairman. They're waving at us.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Diane Luther, Director of the Mental Health Association. 5-day police holds could happen at any local hospital, or it could happen at Damish or elsewhere. That is not, however, a commitment, and the person has not been ruled to be dangerous. But a commitment takes place to the mental health division. Then they could be in a state hospital or could be in another state hospital, but if they are committed, it is to the division.
Could they be in a private hospital with such a commitment, with placement in a private hospital?
As I believe so, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, they could, definitely.
How does the mental... May I ask a question? How does the Mental Health Association feel about the idea that 4 years after such a commitment, you in effect would be under a disability as to possessing a firearm unless you convince the circuit judge that it was okay?
Mr. Chair, we would be comfortable with that time limit, yes. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I could bring up another part of that same issue, there has been some discussion as to whether the commitment should be for dangerousness or just be a commitment, because you can be committed never having been violent, never having threatened anyone, never having been dangerous, but just found to have been unable to care for yourself, and you could be committed on that basis.
Chairman? Yes, Representative Minnick.
Isn't that a part of a broader category, the McNaughton rule? Concept that if you're unable to care for yourself, you're dangerous to yourself.
Well, those are two separate concepts in the commitment statute. You can be unable to care for yourself and not be considered by the judge to be dangerous to yourself.
Mr. Chair. Lawrence Young with the Attorney General's Office. You're referring to the, Representative Minnis is referring to the McNaughton rule or the Durham rule, various rules that are used for convictions. Under ORS 426.005, which defines mentally ill, one of the grounds or one of the reasons you can be found mentally ill is because you're dangerous to self or others, which is what the amendments which have been proposed by committee counsel include. Another grounds for mentally ill is somebody that is unable to provide for basic needs, as Ms. Luther was just pointing out. There was a meeting of a subset of the group this morning in Speaker Katz's office regarding a number of mental health issues, and at least one of the issues that was waltzed around for a considerable period of time, off and on, was whether or not people who are essentially unable to care for themselves